Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 7th of November, these are our main stories. Iran says its nuclear programme is back in business, and at the same time, France's President Macron issues a dire warning about the future of NATO. Police in Paris are clearing more than 1,000 migrants from makeshift camps. And
we want to live a good life. We don't have electricity, we don't have water, we don't have money.
We hear about the discontent that's fueled massive protests in Lebanon in recent weeks. Also in this podcast,
for murder and attempted murder as a crime against humanity and as a war crime, 30 years.
One of Africa's most feared warlords is jailed at the International Criminal Court. And Caitlyn Jenner, one of the world's most famous transgender women, talks to us about her extraordinary life. It's been more than a year since Donald Trump pulled out of an international agreement that limited Iran's nuclear development. And while European leaders have tried to keep the deal together, Iran has spent months violating its terms. Now, with the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency about to hold a special board meeting, Iran has stripped one of its inspectors of her accreditation to work in the country. A spokesman for Iran's atomic energy organization, Behrouz Kamalvandi, has said work on nuclear materials has resumed at yet another facility.
The operation started at midnight, and we are currently collecting enriched uranium. This will gradually reach a sustainable level, so we expect the enrichment level to reach 4.5% on Saturday morning. The entire operation was done in the presence of United Nations inspectors.
I asked our defence and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus what we have heard from Iran about its reason for taking away a nuclear inspector's accreditation.
Well, the Iranians deny that they detained the inspector. They certainly accept that they barred her from entering the facility at Natanz. And they say that this was because when she went into the facility, alarms were set off and that they refer in some sense to something she was carrying, setting those alarms off. So they claim they have a reason for doing so. It's been condemned by the IAEA, by the United States, by other key members of the organisation. And we think this is the first time since the IAEA began monitoring aspects of this nuclear agreement with Iran that anything like this has happened. It's part and parcel, of course, of a growing pattern of, I suppose you'd say, misbehaviour by Iran in the wake of the United States' overturning of the whole deal. The US walked away. Iran now, in four sets of activities, has walked away from various of its commitments under the terms of that agreement. You're left, I suppose, a little bit like a very famous sketch in the British comedy programme Monty Python's Flying Circus. If anybody is familiar with that, the dead parrot sketch. Mm-hmm. There's a dead parrot. The person trying to sell it is trying to say, no, the parrot's very much alive. Well, this JCPOA agreement, is it dead? Is it still alive? Is it on life support? Is it in critical condition? Choose what phrase you want. But a certain point clearly comes where the agreement has to be said that it's no longer functioning.
And there's another crisis brewing, not unrelated. The President of France, Emmanuel Macron, has said that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, is suffering from brain death. What does he mean?
Yes, it's an extraordinary statement. And of course, it comes only a few weeks before a summit meeting in London, which is supposed to mark NATO's 70th anniversary, 70 years of existence. What the French president seems to be saying is, I think it's very much directed at Donald Trump, who's described some of NATO's members as delinquent for not paying sufficiently their own way in defence. He doesn't seem to enshrine the attitude, the approach to the alliance that other leaders have done. done in the United States. Basically, Mr. Macron is saying between that and the way the Turks have unilaterally behaved in Syria, there is not enough coordination in NATO, there isn't enough strategic thinking within the alliance, and that, you know, even things like the Article 5 agreement, the fundamental commitment, if a nation is attacked, what the others will do to help defend it, is in a sense called into question by Turkey's behaviour. If Syria went and attacked Turkey now because of what Turkey has done in Syria, what would the Article 5 response be, asks Mr. Macron.
Jonathan Marcus, our defence and diplomatic correspondent. French police have begun clearing more than 1,000 migrants from makeshift camps in northern Paris. Many migrants are believed to have been living on these sites for a number of months. One of the people being moved on said the camps were in a poor state.
It's a really bad condition for all immigration here. It's not good environment. It's very cold. The weather is too cold. Also, it's every time it's rain coming. The ground is wet. It's not for good for life.
Our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson told me more about this operation.
Well, it looks like they've now finished clearing the parts of the camp they were set on clearing today. About 1,600 people have now been moved out. It's only about half the total number of people that are thought to be living in what is actually a series of separate camps in the northeast of Paris. And what's happening now is the police are clearing the area. They're sweeping away all the tents and possessions and things that have been left behind, as they normally do. It should be said that aid workers in the area are telling us there is massive congestion, that it seems to be much more extensive and the area seems to be closed off for much longer than it has been in the past. And I think that's part of the government's new hardline take on migrants in the capital. They're trying to ensure that people don't simply come straight back and set up their tents again.
Well, that was my next question. Who are these people and where are they going to go?
Well, there are lots of different people from lots of different countries, all here for different reasons. The question of where they're going to go is a really good one, because I think part of the reason this camp has grown so big and so well established over the last year or two is that there simply isn't enough places to house migrants while they wait for their asylum claims to be processed. Even we've met some migrants who have had their claims accepted, that they're given refugee status in France, and yet they still have nowhere to go. And so the government yesterday, as part of its new announcements on handling migration, said they were going to open up thousands and thousands of new spaces for migrants, and they were going to have a big push on camps like this one to have them all cleared by the end of the year.
Why is the government doing this? Is it to head off a potential challenge from the far right?
I think that is exactly what a lot of people here are saying. They've got local elections happening early next year, and the polls at the moment suggest it is going to be a race between President Macron's party and Rassemblement National, which is the far-right party led by Marine Le Pen. It does seem to be the duel that is shaping French politics at the moment, and both parties see those elections as a really crucial test.
Lucy Williamson speaking to me from Paris. In China, a court in the city of Shanghai has condemned a man to a suspended death sentence and eight others to prison for illegally selling and trafficking fentanyl, a powerful opioid, to US buyers. The court said this was the first successful joint operation by Beijing and the US authorities. So how exactly did this cooperation come about against a backdrop of trade war between the two countries? Carney Sharp spoke to our correspondent Robin Brandt, who's in Shanghai.
Well, it goes back to 2017, according to US officials from the embassy in Beijing, an operation that originated in the United States when officials there became aware of a suspect who was helping their investigation, who was ordering fentanyl and other products from Chinese suppliers. So it goes back to then. It came to a head in the autumn of 2017. So that's almost 2 years ago, when multiple people were targeted in both the US and here in China in what basically was an operation where fentanyl, which is legal and is legally manufactured and various components and parts of it manufactured here in China, it's an operation in which fentanyl was being smuggled, usually via courier operations, you know, US Postal Service, DHL, FedEx, that type of thing, to clients in the United States. So come forward 2 years later, and nine people were sentenced in a court in a northern city of Xintai here today, one of them given a suspended death sentence. So it's the culmination of a joint operation, the first, the Chinese officials say, between the Chinese narcotics authorities here and US law enforcement on the United States side. I have to say, much heralded by the Chinese in particular, because fentanyl and its smuggling to the United States has been heavily criticised from the top down. Comments from Donald Trump saying the Chinese are just not doing enough to deal with the supply of the opioid.
Indeed, and he said that last August, saying that they weren't doing enough. And now we're seeing China cooperating here. Tell us how significant this cooperation could be, given the fact that we saw a strain in the trade relationships between the two countries.
Well, look, it's timely, isn't it? We have this ongoing trade war that shows no prospect really of reaching any significant conclusion. And yet here, 2 years after this operation, joint operation, we're told, kind of pretty much came to a head. All of a sudden, we have the sentencing of nine people in a court here in China, and the Chinese very keen to talk about it. Fentanyl, as I've said, is something the US president has talked about. I think almost 30,000 people killed by overdosing on it in the US in 2017. Highly addictive, 50 times more addictive than heroin. And Donald Trump wants the Chinese to do something about the supply. I mean, there has been a time when the Chinese government has used tax breaks to encourage people in its pharmaceutical sector to manufacture fentanyl here. It's the export and the smuggling to the United States that's been a problem. The Chinese on the other side say the Americans need to do more about demand. But nonetheless, this may go somewhere towards ameliorating some of those concerns that Donald Trump has.
Robin Brant in Shanghai speaking to Carney Sharp. For almost 3 weeks across Lebanon, hundreds of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets demanding their government step down. And young people have been at the forefront of those demonstrations, as Martin Patience reports from Beirut.
Well, we're almost 3 weeks in to the protests in Lebanon, and we're still hearing the cries for a revolution. It's been an extraordinary period in this country where people have put aside their differences and have come together and demand that all their political leaders resign. And in front of me is what's been dubbed Revolution Wall. It's a blast wall, but now it's covered in artwork, which has been done by the protesters. There's caricatures of politicians, there's revolutionary slogans, and there's a phoenix rising from the ashes. Just going to speak to one of the artists. Sorry, what's your name?
Hayat Nazir.
We're almost 3 weeks into these protests. What do you feel you've achieved?
We've achieved a lot. What we've achieved, I feel, as a protester, we achieved love towards one another, unity. In this revolution, we feel that sectarianism is not there anymore. Not completely, but with the protesters. We are protesting as one. We don't want to think of religion. We don't want to think of politicians. We just want Lebanon. We're just raising one flag, which is the Lebanese flag.
So what now then?
I think Lebanon is one of the hardest countries in the world, the politics inside, because everything, it's like a spider web, you know, everything is related to one another. So for now, we're asking to stop the corruption and to get our minimal rights. I mean, the human rights, we're not asking for bigger things. We're asking for the minimum, really.
So where the protests normally take place, you're just strolling through. What's your name, sir?
Wasim.
Wasim, and
I'm Layla.
Neither of you have been to the protest.
No.
Why? You're a university student. I imagine a lot of your friends have been.
I just don't like what happened in the protest. Like, a lot of shops are destroyed. Like Puma, for example. It's the only Puma outlet here in Lebanon, and people there lost their job. Why?
All the politicians, no exceptions, are stealing our money. We're here because we want to stop that. We want to live a good life. We don't have electricity. We don't have water. We don't have money.
But you didn't come out onto the streets.
I didn't. And what, because why? I have work. And because of the protest, because of the closing of the streets, we're going to earn a low
salary.
A low salary.
Because we work per hour. not per month. And I only work like 12 days in October, so I'm not going to earn anything, and I pay for my university.
Have you got money to pay for your university at the moment?
This month, no, I can't pay anything.
Two young students there, both of whom told me that when they graduate, they'll probably end up working overseas. What young Lebanese want is a country they're proud of and which they believe they have a future in it. And at the moment, most do not see it that way. The country's prime minister may have resigned, but the reality is it's going to take a lot more than that to change this country.
Martin, Patience reporting. And still to come in this edition of our podcast.
The two of the biggest names on the internet, 20 million followers, subscribers each. They really, really are massive.
Why, two of the biggest stars on YouTube will be facing each other in the boxing ring on Saturday. It was the biggest and most complex case in the history of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The man known as the Terminator, Bosco Ntaganda, has been sentenced to 30 years in prison for crimes against humanity in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Those crimes included massacres, rapes, sexual slavery, and forcing children to become rebel soldiers. This is some of what the presiding judge, Robert Fremer, had to say in delivering the sentence.
Victims suffered physical, psychological, psychiatric and social consequences such as ostracization, stigmatization and social rejection. For example, a 13-year-old victim of rape from Mongvalu suffered injuries which took several months to heal and required surgery years later.
So who is Bosco Ntaganda? I heard more about him from our correspondent in The Hague, Anna Holligan.
Among the highlights from the judge today, two attacks on villages in which civilians were mutilated, tied up and bludgeoned to death. Girls were held in a state of sexual slavery. Some schoolgirls, children as young as 9 years old, were raped, and others under the age of 15 were recruited and trained to fight for his rebel militia. And as a reflection of the kind of modern nature of these crimes, during the course of the trial, we saw video footage and photographs too from the DRC, this gold-rich region, which was used as part of the evidence. And he is notably the first person to be convicted for sexual crimes here at the ICC, which is being seen as a victory for the victims, but especially women, in recognition of this gender violence and the fact that, as the prosecutor said, rape is now used as a weapon of war.
He's the only person ever indicted by the ICC who actually handed himself in. Why did he do that?
Well, better alive in The Hague than dead at home, perhaps. The judges just weren't convinced that he'd done an honourable thing by surrendering to the forces of justice, but rather he'd flip-flopped between sides, so fighting for the rebels and then the state army so many times that his life was no longer sustainable out there. And actually, the judge said today, if it was indeed about wishing to take responsibility for these crimes, then he wouldn't have waited 7 years after the arrest warrant was initially issued by the ICC before handing himself in.
Is he likely to appeal against the sentence?
I imagine he will appeal. He is able to appeal, and actually his appeal against the conviction is still being considered. So he will remain in detention until the final judgment, and then there'll be a discussion about where he should serve this time, probably 24 years, given he's already spent 6 in custody.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. Earlier we heard how Iran has withdrawn the accreditation from an international nuclear inspector. This comes as a power struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran continues to be played out across the Middle East in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon and Yemen. Well, Iran is winning that struggle, according to a new report by the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. Dan Damon found out more from Dr. John Chipman, the think tank's director general.
The IISS has assessed that over really the last 40 years, the Islamic Republic of Iran has built a sovereign strategic capability to influence events in its neighborhood. And it has embedded itself in the politics of Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. And as a result, it has changed the effective balance of force in the region. So what we assess is while the Gulf Arab states and many others in the region have spent a lot of money developing conventional capability, it is this asymmetric quality that the Islamic Republic of Iran has brought to its power that has made the big difference in the regional balance of power in the Middle East.
Those who look carefully at video from Iraq battlefields, for example, will know the face of Major General Qasem Soleimani, but he's not an Iranian name that really makes headlines very often.
It's true that Qasem Soleimani has not made headlines that often. On the other hand, he is becoming a lot more prominent as the Islamic Republic of Iran is showing great pride in its capability to exert influence, even recently pitching up in Baghdad in Iraq and allowing public photographs of his presence in Baghdad to be taken. So it's very clear that Iran is showing that despite the sanctions that the United States has imposed on it, it's still able, through the Al-Quds force, to demonstrate its power in the region and persistently engage in the internal politics of a number of the countries, including most dramatically recently in Iraq.
What does the Quds Force have then? Because we can assume because of sanctions, it doesn't have the absolute latest in weaponry.
Well, it does have a capacity to train militias throughout the region, in Syria, in Iraq. Obviously, the most fantastic force it has is really Hezbollah in Lebanon, which it has cultivated over many years. And none of its militia in any of the other countries matches the capability of Hezbollah. But a number of them are very good in causing disturbances. And even the Houthis in Yemen have created a challenge for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So you don't necessarily need the very latest in military kit to still be able to create disturbances and change, as we put it, the effective balance of power in the Middle East.
Dr. John Chipman, Director General of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, speaking to Dan Damon. And now to a confrontation of a very different kind.
The first fight was incredible. This time, no head guards. 10-ounce gloves. I have to be honest with you, someone is getting knocked out in Los Angeles on November the 9th.
That was the boxing promoter Eddie Hearn talking about a fight this coming Saturday between two YouTube stars, Logan Paul and KSI, who have a combined following of 40 million people. For the second time in 2 years, they'll square off in a boxing match at a sold-out arena with millions of fans watching on pay-per-view television. Eleanor Roper from BBC Newsbeat has spoken to them about this, and I asked her about Logan Paul and KSI. What's different about this fight?
Well, when it comes to YouTube celebrities, they don't come much bigger than this. They're two of the biggest names on the internet, 20 million followers, subscribers each. They really, really are massive. And what's different about this fight is, well, they're not boxers, basically. They're entertainers online. They're famous for doing silly stunts, for gaming, for music. They had this sort of online beef and decided to have a fight. That was in August of last year. And they did that as amateur boxers. So they were wearing head guards. That was in Manchester. And to be honest, nobody took it seriously. Everyone turned their noses up at it, apart from the people who get it. They're real fans. And it sold out. They made internet history. 1 million people streamed it online and they sold out Manchester Arena. Now, the row continues. It was a draw last time around. This time they're fighting as professional cruiserweights. They've converted Eddie Hearn, as you heard talking there. He's the biggest boxing promoter in the UK. He's now on board. He's now converted, saying himself that maybe he perhaps didn't take it as seriously as he should have done. But obviously there is money to be made there. He's got behind them. They've now been training with professional trainers. They will fight on Saturday in Los Angeles as professional boxers. Now, I asked KSI and then Logan Paul how important it was for them to be taken seriously as boxers, not just as entertainers.
People are always going to judge me for whatever, so I don't really care too much. I kind of just let the fighting do the talking.
I'm not so worried about how I'm perceived as well as my performance, because I think that'll speak for itself. Like, if I want to be on your show and be goofy and make jokes, like, I'm going to do that. And I'm fine if people don't take me seriously as a boxer, but then I think when I'm in the ring, it's going to be very obvious that I am a boxer.
Okay, so they're going to make a fortune out of this. Is it just a publicity stunt and have we fallen victim to it?
No, I really don't think that it is just a publicity stunt. I mean, I went to interview both of them. I went to their London press conference. I've covered a lot of boxing press conferences. I have never seen crowds like this. Even, you know, with the likes of someone like Anthony Joshua, who was a 3-time heavyweight world champion. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people queuing around the block just to get a glimpse of them. They really are massive. To underestimate it would not be a good idea. And I think also the numbers speak for themselves. You know, 1 million people watched it last time. This time around, it's actually being streamed on the streaming service DAZN. So I think more people are probably going to watch it this time around. We'll just have to see. I mean, the quality of the boxing is probably going to speak for itself. But I imagine it's going to attract a whole new audience of sports fans, maybe.
In a word, who's going to win?
I've got no idea.
Eleanor Roper, refreshingly honest from BBC Newsbeat. Caitlyn Jenner is the most famous transgender woman in the world. Once she was called the greatest athlete in the world after winning decathlon gold at the 1976 Olympics as Bruce Jenner. And here in Britain, it's reported that she'll be appearing in the next series of the reality TV programme I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Our reporter Simon Mundy recently went to her house in Malibu to talk about her life and the lessons she's learned along the way.
I have the great double, Olympic decathlon champion and Glamour's Woman of the Year. I hope nobody ever has to go through that in their lives, please. Yeah.
Growing up as Bruce, Caitlin struggled with dyslexia and gender dysphoria, which is where there's a mismatch between someone's biological sex and their gender identity. Caitlin spoke about being drawn to her mother's closet age 10 and dressing up in her clothes.
People suffering from gender dysphoria, basically you're born that way, just like you're right-handed or you're left-handed. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all these great explanations of this and stuff. It's just who you are, okay? But yeah, I used to sneak in there and try stuff on and do this and then go out. Sometimes we lived in an apartment complex, go out and sneak out and get around. I just felt comfortable doing it. But back then, nobody knew anything about it, and I didn't know anything about it. You know, being dyslexic, gender dysphoric, you know, these types of things going on in my life, kind of struggling in school a little bit, that's what made me. Because for me, when I got into sports, it became more important for me personally to succeed at sports and to work hard at sports because of all these issues.
It was at college that the decathlon grabbed her attention. Caitlin trained 6 to 8 hours a day, 365 days a year for 4 years in preparation for the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. Jenner was favourite for gold and duly delivered, smashing the world record in the process. But the morning after receiving the gold medal and being crowned the world's greatest athlete, a feeling of fear arose.
A lot of the training and was really running away from a lot of the issues I had. And I remember getting up the next morning, didn't have a stitch of clothes on, walk into the bathroom, put the medal around my neck, look in the mirror and go, what have you just done? Did you build up this character so big that you're stuck with them for the rest of your life? It was scary.
Fame and fortune quickly followed, including a screen test for the role of Superman. But once the work began to dry up in the 80s, Caitlin began to isolate herself.
I spent 6 years in a house down here because I didn't really want to come out because I never felt like I fit in anywhere.
Mm. You talked about gender dysphoria at that point being all-consuming. What was that experience like then in the 80s of being consumed by this? And how did you cope?
Oh, I had dealt with it for so long, but I had never faced it. I did start on hormones back then. I started with electrolysis. Yeah, it was extraordinarily painful.
Caitlin eventually decided not to transition in the 80s and instead married Chris Kardashian, becoming stepfather to Kourtney, Kim and Khloe. They had two more daughters, Kylie and Kendall.
Actually got caught by Kim once. Kendall and Kylie, I didn't know I got caught, but they said they snuck around a corner or something. I don't know, and I was cross-dressed or whatever. But they all knew, and they certainly had seen all the tabloids with me every week. They know, but nobody's going to talk about it. Okay, it's the big secret.
In 2015, Caitlin came out as a transgender woman. She appeared on the front of Vanity Fair magazine as Caitlin for the first time.
The bottom line is, my life is so much better today because I'm honest with myself and I've taken care of myself.
Because you can achieve anything in life. You've proved that. But the real treasure in life is in honesty and peace of mind.
Oh, absolutely. I have a lot of peace of mind now. Having the ability to just wake up in the morning and be yourself all day long.
What means more to you then? Making a difference through transitioning and being Caitlin and being an example like that and putting yourself on a pedestal to help other people raise themselves up, or your Olympic triumph?
I would have to put my identity as higher. First of all, it was tougher to do. You know, I trained for 12 years for the games. I trained 65 years to transition in 2015. It was harder to do. It was less accepted. It wasn't like the right thing to do. Everybody loved the games. What a great story. But a lot of people, when they see you transition, you know, will hate your guts.
Caitlin Jenner speaking to Simon Mundy. And the full interview can be heard on our podcast, Don't Tell Me the Score, which is available to download from BBC Sounds. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson, and until next time, goodbye.